Hello, welcome to the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man and my name is Graham Lee. This is the isolation episode of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast because I have contracted the COVID-19 disease, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. I am okay. I have had a flu-like set of symptoms for about a week. It's mostly worn off. I still have to isolate according to local rules for approximately another week, most of the rest of next week. I've been a little too under the weather to concentrate on much, to do any work. So I've just been doing what studying and note-taking I can for the last few days, and have evidently cobbled an episode of a podcast together. Thank you to those people who replied to the questions in episode 35, A Bored Man with a Microphone, about what it is that you get out of this podcast, and what the sort of structure and interpretation of the structure and interpretation of computer programmers community means to you. It was really useful and interesting to get those replies, so thanks everyone. It definitely seems like the sort of interpretation and the experience I have in software engineering is useful enough, hopefully not entirely unique, because that would just make me a bizarre outlier, but useful enough and at least different in enough ways to just be interesting and educational to the people who replied. So thank you for that, and I will intend to carry on in similar vein. And of course, if anything comes up in any of these episodes that is worth agreeing with or disagreeing with or challenging or questioning or confirming or otherwise entering into correspondence, you can email me grahamlee@acm.org. You can find me on Twitter. I was Lee G. There's probably other places online you can find me as well, but those will do for now. So today's episode, my theory that I want to talk about in today's episode, and I apologize for the rather perpetual coughing that you'll hear through this. It's going to be very difficult to edit out. It doesn't come as sporadic fits I can just stop the microphone for, or slice out of the audio in an edit. It's just occasional and continuous hack. My theory is that most of the things that developers get worked up about the way that software is developed, don't actually have an impact on the outcomes of their software development. At least not in the ways that are material to that software and to the customers and to the organization that the software is being built for. Now, this could imply a corollary. Maybe the things that do have a big impact on the outcome of the software endeavor are other things that developers aren't paying any attention to. And that's definitely worthy of exploration, but that'll be a separate episode, I think, because of the amount of stuff I came up with in preparing the first half, which is that the things we get worked up about are not the things that have an impact on the project. So let's work backwards. Let's start with the top level outcomes that we want to affect, and see whether those are affected by typical software engineering things that people get angry about, like choice of programming language, use of particular paradigms, whether developers are writing tests or doing continuous integration, those kinds of things. So here we go. So I'm going to take in no particular order the things that I think are the like top level stuff that matters when you're running a software team. Let's start with, can you afford to keep the engineering department running? Now, this kind of depends on the intersection of the cost of doing whatever it is you're doing and the budget that the executives are willing to give to the CTO or whoever is in charge of the engineering department. And the budget is the biggest and probably easiest number to move rather than the cost. So the negotiating skills of the CTO are going to be much more important than the efficiency of the software engineering team. You know, I've already talked about the fact that there's enough money in software engineering and in many of the software engineering organizations and contexts that there hasn't been a focus on cost control for a very long time. Probably since like the 80s to 90s. It's been possible to just say, oh, we're doing agile, and for that to be a hand-waving thing that says we're following best practice, it costs this much, stop asking. So really, like, nothing that we're going to do is going to make the engineering department more affordable except asking for a bigger budget. Now, you might say, well, hold on, being able to get more budget requires having more revenue, and that requires having a better product, and that requires having better engineering. But no, the way in which the revenue is split is, or rather the way in which the company budget is split, is dependent on what the executives think is going to cause the best changes, the best outcomes, the most likely fulfillment of whatever they think the plan is for the budget period. So this is all sort of forecasting at a waterfall level. It's like, what do you think you're going to do over the next 2 years, 5 years? What do you need to spend in the next year in order to move 50% along the 2-year goal and 20% along the 5-year goal? And that is not necessarily dependent on revenue from either the like fractional split. Do we think we need to sell our existing product to more customers, or do we think we need to develop new capabilities that we can use to acquire interest from those customers? That's kind of a judgment call. But also, the total budget available doesn't necessarily depend on the revenue. So at the moment, I'm working for a university, and the engineering budget is kind of set by salary cost plus overheads, or rather salary cost times multiplier for overheads. That is our budget. And then what we need to do is to associate that with research projects that agree, or rather the funders of those research projects agree to carry those costs as they directly relate to the completion of their project. So there's no question of what revenue is there from these products. The products aren't for sale. It's just a question of, who is there someone out there who's willing to sort of sugar daddy this thing? But the last company I worked in was seed funded, or let's go with seed funded, that's close enough. So the budget came from, we've been given 25 million quid by this investor to spend over the next 5 years, and when that runs out, we either have to find someone else who wants to give us 25 million quid, or have a product that's generating enough revenue that we don't need to do that, or hybrid combination of the two, or sell the company, or whatever. And that's a common thing as well. Once you get to actually having a profitable company, it's not the profits that you're reinvesting, because of course your profits are partly being reinvested, they're partly going to dividends to shareholders or stock buybacks, and so then there's also like, what is going on with the stock market? Are we making a load of money by selling shares in the company that have got nothing to do with selling the product? So the revenue of the software that you're generating is sort of indirectly and in many cases immaterially related to the budget of the engineering division. But it does depend on the costs. But for a lot of teams that I've worked on, the salary costs are way higher than any of the sort of operational budget or hardware budget or anything else that is really under the control of the engineers once their salaries have been paid. The fact that we are paying their salaries, along with all the overheads. So, if you have office space, then you typically charge that to the headcount budget. So you would say, we need a certain square foot of office space with attendant, heating and lighting and air conditioning and maintenance, all that kind of stuff goes into the salary pot. We're going to have to pay tax, national insurance, contributions, health insurance. We're going to have to pay for sort of liability insurance for people coming into the office. We're going to have to pay pension into a pension scheme or retirement plan for those people. We're going to like staff a canteen. All those kinds of things like basically are worked out as multiplier of the headcount. And by the time you've done that, you can probably expect to be paying something like 200% of someone's gross salary on, having a chair and a computer and all of the legal requirements and all of the supporting stuff that goes into getting that person to turn up. It might be somewhat lower if you are allowing people to work remotely, but remember that someone who's working remotely still has the same entitlement to a safe and healthy working setup, and so you may end up spending similar amounts on equipment even if you're not like actually hiring an office. Regardless, for the most part, what you spend on engineering is mostly going to be what you spend on engineers, and secondarily what you spend on like the products they're running. But because of how companies do their budgets, you may find that like it's either easier to spend on what are called operational expenses and capital expenses, i.e. on sort of ongoing outlays rather than equipment, or vice versa. Or you might find that there is a greater amount of money for some rather than others. That rather forces engineering changes than being forced by engineering changes. For example, the idea that it's easier to spend OPEX than CAPEX is one of the motivators for deploying to a public cloud rather than an on-premise data center, because the on-premise data center is capital. It is a building and it is a room with air conditioning and it is a collection of computers in a rack, and those are tangible assets that are part of the company's capital. And if you're not allowed to buy capital, well, you may as well go and use Azure or whatever, because then you don't try to obtain any capital. But remember, that is forcing engineering changes. It is not being forced by engineering changes. So the thing that can really sort of affect this top line, apart from the negotiations that the CTO can make to get their budget through the executive committee and through the board and get the amount of money they want approved, is a buy-build decision. If you take something that is, you know, maybe outside your core value prop and you outsource it to some other developers, or you buy a commercial product, or you adopt an existing open source solution and configure it rather than developing your own version, that is going to be a significant change to the overall cost of doing the engineering, and probably is going to be a much more quicker, greater and more obvious change than any change in engineering practices without changing the magnitude of the work. Think of it like performance engineering. You know, do you make this algorithm 10% faster, or do you stop running it completely because you don't actually need the results from that algorithm? Or do you run it once and cache it and then only ever look up the result? Or do you run it every time you need the result? Those changes make much more impact on the performance of the system than saying, okay, I've worked out how to unroll this loop and make this algorithm 2% faster, just like not running the algorithm at all. The same is true with spending money. You can not spend money on something, and you know, if you buy a license for a commercial product, then you are not staffing your team to develop the equivalent of that product. So, second top level thing that affects the outcome of a software project is, do customers want the thing that you're doing? Are you actually creating a thing? And let's, this is perhaps dangerous, but I'm going to conflate this anyway. I have seen it fail on commercial projects. Do customers want the thing you're doing, and is it consistent with the mission of your company? I'm going to put into one single question. Now, unsurprisingly, the big thing we should be measuring here is customer acceptance. Anything else you do, you might say, well, obviously our customers want bug-free software, so obviously we're going to pick language with automatic memory management, so we don't have memory reference bugs, and we're going to do a load of testing with TDD and unit tests, so that we don't have any logic bugs. And actually, those all fail to answer the question: do customers actually want this thing? Because, maybe customers would accept something that has, some level of memory management problems, but does the thing that they want. Maybe they're happy to just buy more RAM in order to have this software. I've heard of high frequency trading companies where they write the code in Java because they had a load of Java developers who knew how to write Java very effectively, and then just bought a ton of RAM and turned off the garbage collector while the exchange was open between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. and then kill the process at 4 p.m. and relaunch it at 10 a.m. the next day, because solving memory management issues and making a correct use of the system's memory cost more than having an algorithm that was available to work today and could and could trade. So this idea that correctness, which is the thing that engineers worry about, is necessarily a driver of acceptance, which is the thing that customers worry about, does not hold. Any methodology that asserts that software is better or more valuable or correct because the engineer says so and has a green tick on their dashboard cannot even be a proxy metric for customer acceptance, because it asks the wrong person. Asks the wrong question of the wrong person. Now, typically, we don't really ask about customer acceptance directly to customers either. We ask indirect questions How many customers do we have? How many customers are leaving us? How satisfied are our customers? How much money are they giving us? And those are all valid proxy metrics for customer acceptance. And those are the things that will actually change the success of the software project. Even if your main source of income isn't revenue, if you can show that customers accept your product, then you can convince investors to give you more seed money or another venture round or whatever. And then even competitive analysis is secondary, because competitive analysis is answering the question, if we are not acquiring or retaining customers at the levels that we would like, is it because they are finding something else rather than our product that fulfills this need? Competitive analysis is a thing we do in order to answer the question, are our products acceptable to our customers? And it leads to the next question, which therefore is not really high level thing that matters to a software project, except that if you are in the commercial sector and you don't have any competitors, then you probably have the wrong product anyway, because you're not a unique snowflake. You haven't identified a thing that only you have thought of that everybody else wants. If only you have thought of it, it's likely that nobody else wants it because nobody else has thought of it, and so doesn't realize that that's the thing that they might want. So just think about this in terms of all of the big technology companies now. They are all doing things that already existed. They're just maybe doing it better or using the marketing effects and scale that they have to succeed at things that other people were already doing. Microsoft make developer tools and operating systems. They weren't the first people to do that. In fact, their first product was a BASIC, and they weren't the first people to come up with BASIC. That was Dartmouth University. The Apple make computers. They aren't the only people who do that. Google, fundamentally, information organization retrieval, the libraries have existed for millennia now. Netflix offer movie rentals. That's not a new business. All of these companies are doing things in very strongly competitive spaces. Facebook were not even in the first generation of social networking software. So these successful companies are not ones that have unique products that nobody else has thought of. They're ones that have particularly valuable implementations, for whatever reason, of products that lots of people have thought of, and typically operate in fairly competitive spaces. So that is the argument that elevates competitive analysis to a sort of first order important thing, even though effectively it's second order, because if you're not competing, then something is going madly wrong. And competitive analysis causes us to answer this question. Can we keep up with all of the engineering that we need to do? Because if we have competitors, then either we need to catch up with features that they have, or we need to innovate to make it harder for them to catch up, or we need to identify gaps that none of the competitors is serving so that we have a unique value prop for our offering, or whatever it is. We need to sort of, in that Red Queen from Alice in Wonderland style, we need to continually be running in order to stand still. Now that puts a sort of lower limit on the amount of engineering we can do. We've already talked about the fact that a massive driver on that is changing the budget. Because the changing the budget is an easy-ish thing to do, you know, you can always say to the executive team, look, these competitors have all got this feature that we're lacking. I want to hire a team to build this feature in the next year, rather than take people off of these teams in order to build that feature and then fall back on these other capabilities which the competitors can also do. And that is one of the reasons that engineering teams tend to grow over time. It's always easier to say, we'll just add another group of people to do this, even though adding another group of people to do this adds all of the communication complexities and so on that like Fred Brooks and everyone has been talking about for decades. But like it's much more likely that you will succeed at getting a new feature done by growing the team than it is by growing the capability of the team to the point where it has the capacity to add this other engineering workload to its to its output. Whether that is because of the engineering practices or because of the ease of having that negotiation, that is the most likely way for it to happen. I mean, many teams could benefit from changing communication practices. This typically is something that, like, you get, you know, the people like the agile consultants of the world are very keen on. So there is a subset of software engineers who would like to sort of change that part of the world. In practice, a lot of engineers kind of think of themselves as a large collection of lone wolves who would like to be given their task from the backlog, go into their cave, not be interrupted by anyone with their headphones on while they implement this thing, and then come back and have it, you know, approved to adulation and applause in the pull request review. And in fact, those organizations could benefit from changing their communication style and the way in which their developers and their engineers work together. However, that is likely to yield, admittedly compounding, incremental benefits, but nonetheless incremental benefits. It's unlikely to change the overall survival characteristic of the team. If you are falling behind because your competitors are building faster than you, then incremental improvements in the way in which your teams communicate could eventually mean that you accelerate past those competing teams. But whether it will happen before all of your customers have gone away to the competitors is not as clear as, you know, getting another 10 million quid in VC funding and using that to stand up a new team that can catch up with those competitors. And once again, this idea of can we keep up with the engineering is actually mostly answered by buy versus build. Can I reduce the amount of engineering that my team needs to do in order to catch up with those features? So maybe I'm in antivirus, and the thing that everybody else has that I don't is automated credit card renewals when the virus definitions need updating, and that actually I should just buy a off-the-shelf online storefront and deploy that rather than engineering one. So here is the intersection. This is the top level idea in the success or failure of a software project that I think is where there is an intersection between the engineering practices and the success or failure of the project. And even this is not a clear-cut one. And the point is this: are you operating with an acceptable level of risk? Of course, acceptable to whom? Is it the customers? Is it the management? It's typically the executive management. Typically, when something is perceived to have gone wrong, the management wants them. No. Why did this go wrong? Did we know that this was going wrong? What did we do about it? And frankly, if the answer to like those things is yes, we knew it was going wrong, yes, we did something about it, and yet it went wrong nonetheless, you're probably all right. As long as the company doesn't go out of business, as long as you don't, like, you know, break some kind of, you know, trading law to the point where, like, the SEC or someone, like, suspends your license to operate as a publicly traded company, you know, the management themselves will probably be happy that, you know, that this was a black swan event, that you had prepared to some reasonable amount and that something unreasonable happened. That's pretty much acceptable in many businesses. But in order to answer the question, are we operating with an acceptable level of risk, we have to know what risks we run, which I don't think many software engineering teams necessarily pay attention to, and we have to know what acceptable is. We have to know what our management are happy to deal with, you know, because at some point you have to say, okay, well, yeah, you know, we've done what we can. We are going to accept that anything outside of this is, you know, is beyond our control. And when faced with ideas of risk, project risk, or of you know, product risk, or of legal risk, or whatever, engineers tend to reach straight for the mitigation strategies. They tend to reach straight for the, okay, so what more engineering can I do in order to avoid this thing happening? Right, there is some risk that our product will crash on the customer system because it runs out of memory. Okay, what is the tool that I need to add that will reduce, like, memory allocation issues? But that is only one of the things you can do in order to manage risk. There are basically, like, four top level things that you can do. You can accept the risk. You can say, okay, well, this could happen. Let's just let it happen because the cost of cleaning up is lower than the cost of doing anything else. You can transfer the risk, i.e. you can take out an insurance policy and say, okay, we're going to spend a finite and understood amount of money every year so that if this risk comes to pass, it's handled by somebody else and they have to deal with the fallout. Or, you know, the other thing that comes under transference is you can say, we're going to make it clear to the customer that it's their problem to deal with this if it happens. Or, you know, if you like, rely on other vendors to produce part of your software solution, you can transfer the risk to them. That you can say, if this thing goes wrong and it's, you know, due to a fault in your product, or it is caused by your product, then you are on the hook for resolving that. You can mitigate, which is what we've been talking about, which is where you put in place controls that either reduce the impact of the disaster if the risk comes to pass, or reduce the likelihood of it happening, or both. Or you can avoid the risk. You can say, this thing is really difficult, we are not going to do it. We are not going to enter into that line of business because the risks associated with it are too high for us to want to do anything about. So the reason that I think this is where the intersection of software project success and engineering practice lies is that basically all engineering practices that come down to, if they affect the project at all, affecting its risk stance. But if you haven't got a systematic approach to risk, you can't quantify what the effect of the engineering practice is on the overall project risk, which means that you can't be clear that you are reducing the risk of the project in any meaningful way. For example, let's say that we have decided that everybody needs to always write a failing test before any production code gets written, and that every every commit needs to be demonstrated to make a failing test pass before it can be accepted, and that what we think we are getting out of this is improved correctness of the software, because we know that all we know what all of the software does, and we know that it contributes to making this like battery of tests pass. Well, the more tests we write, the slower our test suite is going to be. The more tests we make engineers write, the slower their production of code is going to be. What opportunity cost does this introduce? Yeah, but maybe there are tests that are just really hard to design, and so a developer wants to write one line of code, ends up spending 3 days trying to work out how to create a test that is going to demonstrate that one line of code has a meaningful impact. What weren't they doing for those 3 days? What are you failing to do because of the effort you're putting in to this like mitigation task? So that was my framework of how like software projects succeed or fail, and why most sort of engineering practices don't actually contribute in a significant way to the success or failure of those software projects. That doesn't mean that the engineering practices we do don't matter. It just means that they matter not to the overall success or failure of the project, or maybe not even to the overall sort of characteristics of the software project. For example, we can draw a reasonable line. You know, we might not have measured it, but we could certainly make a justifiable argument to say that adopting practices that engineers find like, you know, interesting and compelling has a good effect on their morale, and that might make them more committed, which might make them more productive, although we're not really measuring productivity of software engineering, and it's, you know, it's not really a process that has a clear sort of productivity metric anyway, but it could definitely increase staff retention, which reduces the costs of maintaining the engineering headcount, and the headcount is the most expensive part of the engineering budget, and therefore there is a link between letting our engineers do these things and like the high level budget of the engineering organization, which is the biggest effect on you know, on its viability. We could make that argument. We could find that, you know, activities that developers are doing actually do make the developers more efficient. But because that isn't being considered holistically within the overall performance of the project, it actually has no effect on the project performance. The engineers are doing a lot of things very well that are then held up by some other constraint from ever getting into the customer's hands, or from ever getting into like the revenue stream of the company. And so, you know, we might find that developers end up occupied on other sort of make work tasks. We end up with like, you know, big developer efficiency teams who are building internal tooling and so on, not because we need the developers to be any more efficient, but because we need to sort of dissipate all of that software developer energy that is going very well into constructing software, but that can't possibly go into constructing software that's incrementally adding value for our customers. Now, in those cases, where the thing is just to like make our lives better, or to give us something to do, or, you know, because it's interesting and makes us happy and makes us, you know, more efficient without affecting the project, there's no point in getting any like management buy-in to them, because they're not going to affect the outcome of the project. So these should be things that we just do. I often say to developers, on teams where there isn't a norm of adopting some common practice, like let's say that there's a team that doesn't have a normative approach to writing unit tests, and a developer says, I want to write unit tests, but nobody writes unit tests around here. How do I convince everyone that we should be writing unit tests? I often say, well, you don't. You just write the unit tests. And you say, this is how I work. And then they say, well, how do I justify that in my estimates to my product owner when, you know, someone who doesn't write the tests, like, will take this long, and I want to write the tests and it will take me this long. How do I justify that? And I say, you don't. You just say, this is how long it will take me to build this feature using what I believe are acceptable engineering practices. And, you know, if they want to quibble over that estimate, that is up to them. But if they want to quibble over the way that you work, then they are not in a position where they're entitled to do so, because, yeah, they're the product owner, they're not the developer. They get to decide what goes into the product, not which buttons you press on your PC. And that is because the practices that people are typically asking me about are ones that don't have any material impact on the project and on the outcome of the whole software engineering activity. Now, I'm sorry that that might not be what you want to hear. You might want to hear that, like, you know, switching from like C to Rust is going to increase your revenue by 250%. Unfortunately, I don't think that's true. I think that you know, building the wrong software in whatever language you want is going to cause more projects to fail than the correct choice, where I had my scare quote fingers going around the word correct choice of programming language. It won't have any kind of effect on the success or failure of the product at a high level. Now, here's how you tell. If you want to be a bit more rational and a bit more objective about this, and you want to tell whether your intervention, you know, your change of programming language, your change of practice, your new technique, whatever it is, whether it has an effect on the software project, here's what you do. You run a case study. You pick one of your teams or one of your projects, and you try this thing on that with that team or on that project, and you don't try it on all of the other teams and all of the other projects. And you decide at the start what you think this is going to change and how you measure that variable, how you measure that thing that may or may not change. And you measure it across all of the projects, the one where you did implement this intervention and the ones where you didn't. And then, you know, you see whether there is a meaningful impact. Now, in order to do in order to know that the thing you are changing is the thing that you want to change, you need to have already been measuring it, because you need to already know that this is where the problem in your engineering effort lies. You know, it's no good improving the ability of your team to deliver on requests coming from the sales department if your problem is that sales are requesting the wrong things, or that the software can't handle more customers. Because, you know, let's say that you got better at implementing requests from sales, that drove acquisition, but then didn't drive retention because your software performs so poorly that everybody goes off to a competitor. So we need to already know that the thing that our intervention is going to change is worth changing. And the way that we do that is post-mortem reviews. We need to already be measuring the performance of our software projects. We need to be able to look back at that data and say, what has not been performing very well about our projects? Either what caused them to fail, or what caused them to cost more than they should have, or what caused, like, lower customer satisfaction. You know, any of these high-level ideas that we were talking about earlier on in the podcast. And you need to be able to, like, have a hypothesis that changing this variable will cause a change in one of these high-level variables based on the data that you've already gathered from your post-mortem reviews. And then you need a hypothesis that changing this practice will change our performance on this variable. So what you've got effectively is what's called a leading metric and a lagging metric. The lagging one is the one that we want to change. It's the customer retention. It's the customer satisfaction. It's the revenue from the product. But you can't do anything that directly changes the revenue or the customer satisfaction. What you can do is change things that you think are related to those, and then observe. And so this is the leading metric. So let me say that I think that keeping up with competitor features will improve our customer retention. Therefore, what I want to do is to implement an intervention that will increase our capability to keep up with our competitors. So effectively our rate of adding features to the product. So I'm going to measure the rate at which features get added to the product. I am going to introduce this intervention on a team, and I'm going to carry on measuring the rate at which features get added. If it turns out that this intervention increases that rate, then we'll declare it a success and we'll roll it out. And then we should hopefully see the rest of the engineering organization getting better at adding features to the product. Then, later, we should hopefully see that this causes an increase in customer retention. Now, most software teams aren't, in fact, doing any of that. And no, agile retrospectives don't count. What an agile retrospective tends to do is to take a subset of the team, typically the people who are directly involved in the sort of software construction bit. So somewhere between writing a story into Jira and signing off on its QA, or all of the people who have a task in between those two boundaries in the middle of the project, and say, what do we think went well or badly last time, and what do we think we should improve next time? There's no measurement particularly. There's no rational or objective approach taken. There's just a discussion of what we would like to do differently, and therefore no actual meaningful or demonstrable impact on the outcome of the software development endeavor. And the thing that you can change in order to make that more rational and more data-driven is to try, is to actually collect the data, is to be systematic about measurements. And no, velocity does not count in this case. Velocity is rate at which we developed the things compared with the rate at which we thought we were going to develop the things, which doesn't tell you anything about whether those things were beneficial, whether they were desirable, whether they were positive in any sense whatsoever, whether they had any meaningful change to the customer's perception of the value of the product. It doesn't tell you whether the thing you are improving is your ability to develop software or your ability to overstate the magnitude of small tasks so that your numbers move up, or your ability to understate the effort involved so that your performance goes up. It's entirely an internal metric. It's entirely a vanity metric. It's point where velocity has a point. It should be to tell you something about whether you have a sustainable pace of development, whether the amount of work you're doing, which in an abstract form it kind of measures, is actually the amount of work that you are capable of doing without, like, you know, requiring loads of overtime or burning people out, or you know, people working weekends, or other undesirable characteristics. It definitely does not tell you anything about the success or failure of the software project. It is not something that is worth reporting or tracking or you know, or optimizing for in any sense. Anyway, that is it for this episode. I was correct to put off the other half of the discussion on whether things that have a big outcome don't get people worked up. Although, like, I suppose we did touch on that to quite an extent during this episode anyway, in that, you know, we talked about the fact that engineers don't actually care about the budget of the engineering department, which is one of the biggest impacts on the success or failure of the engineering. Maybe we should look at, in a future episode, how engineers could consider those things and what they ought to be thinking about in those regards. Love to hear your views on that. GrahamLee@acm.org or Twitter, IWasLeeG. Thank you very much for listening. Hopefully the next time that I talk to you, I will actually have any sense of smell or taste, or be able to, like, enjoy a cup of coffee while I'm talking to you, rather than the glass of water I've got in front of me, which tastes exactly the same as coffee at the moment. Anyway, I hope that you are all well out there, and I will speak to you again soon.